So many of you that I've met over the past few days, and I just want to thank you for coming and tell you something that's really special to my heart today. It's a story about St. Paul's Chapel, and I don't believe that I've presented this before here. I think Michael may have seen it, and I want to say how much I appreciate Michael's invitation to come here. And Pastor Whitney, thank you for allowing me to speak today. Michael's such a dear friend and loyal patriot to our country, and very blessed to have him do what he does by teaching Constitution, Institute on the Constitution, and certainly I've been blessed with that. My experience in the court is one that brought me out of where I was before to learn about God's law and the meaning of God's sovereignty over our country. And I want to tell you a little story today. It's about our history. And if you will, go with me to a courtroom. It could be any courtroom in our country, any federal district court you could go into. And the next witness coming into the room or the courtroom would be a small boy, about 6 years old. And judges don't like to have witnesses on the stand so tender in age. In fact, we're very careful to prepare them to tell the truth when they come on the witness stand. And sometimes it's hard for juries and other people when they see a young child come on the witness stand. I've had many in my courtroom. But this is where the story goes. The judge wraps the gavel, and from the back, a little boy comes in the room. And all the eyes were on this child as he takes the witness stand, and it was deadly silence in the courtroom. So the judge thinks he's going to help the little boy by asking him about the truth. And he leans over to the little boy and he says, could you tell me your name, son? And the little boy says, Johnny, Judge. He said, well, Johnny, are you in school? He says, yes, sir. He said, well, Johnny, let me ask you, do you know what it means to tell the truth? Johnny said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, well, tell me, Johnny, why should little boys tell the truth? Little Johnny looked up to the judge and said, because God says so, Judge. Well, in courtrooms today, they don't like to hear about God. And this judge was a little taken back, a little embarrassed to start talking with a child about God in the courtroom. Because we've so distanced God from the law. If you don't believe me, you could ask a lady by the name of Jennifer Kaufman. She was a district judge in Tennessee, I believe it was. No, in Kentucky. In 2001, it said that the words, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those words were posted in the school. And she said, that's religious and it couldn't be posted. Even though it's in the Declaration of Independence, she said, that couldn't be posted in school because it's religious. Or you can go to Alfred Goodwin in California in 2002 who said that the words under God made it unconstitutional. And we can go to other states like Wisconsin in 2010 where a judge said that the National Day of Prayer could no longer be held. Or you can go to my case, and that's what I want to get Pastor Whitney to show you, a little cross-examination and verdict. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen this. Some of you have seen it recently at the IOC, but it always helps to look at it again and see the arrogance of a prosecutor who would ask you, will you continue to acknowledge God as you said you would here today, even if officials tell you that you can't? Now, I appreciate what Pastor Whitney opened up with these children because I think it blessed me, and it's actually a good illustration of what I was asked at this trial. It's the same thing. It's not new to our world. It's been going on since the days of Nebuchadnezzar and before that when we have put man in the place of God. And you know, when did it first begin? Begin the Garden of Eden. When Satan tempted Eve by saying, we shall make you as gods. You shall be as God, knowing right and wrong, or determining right and wrong. And that's what we're doing today in our country today, is we're putting ourselves in the place of God, just as Pastor Whitney said. So this examination was one which asked me if I would continue to do that. And I want you to watch the prosecutor's facial expression when he asked me, even if officials tell you that you can't. And then he said, we don't want to know why. We just want to know if you'll continue to do that. And he kind of grimaced and shakes his head. That is the kind of arrogance we've got in our prosecutor. But anyway, just watch this little clip.
And your understanding is that the federal court ordered that you could not acknowledge God, isn't that right?
Yes.
And if you resume your duties as Chief Justice after this proceeding, you will continue to acknowledge God as you have testified that you would today.
Absolutely.
No matter what any other official says.
Absolutely. Without, if I can clarify that, without an acknowledgement of God, I cannot do my duty. I must acknowledge God. It says so in the Constitution of Alabama. It says so in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. It says so in everything I've read.
The only point I'm trying to clarify, Mr. Chief Justice, is not why, but only that, in fact, if you do resume your duties as Chief Justice, you will continue to do that without regard to what any other official says. Isn't that right?
Well, I will do the same thing this court did in starting with prayer. That's an acknowledgement of God. I would do the same thing that justices do when they place their hand on the Bible and say, so help me God. It's an acknowledgement of God. The Alabama Supreme Court opens with, God save this state and this honorable court. It's an acknowledgement of God. In my opinions, which I've written many opinions, acknowledging God is the source, a moral source of our law. I think you must.
And your understanding is that the federal court ordered that you could not acknowledge God. Isn't that right?
Yes. Place their hand on the Bible and say, with God save this state and this honorable court. It's an acknowledgement of God. In my opinions, which I've written many opinions, acknowledging God is the source, a moral source of our law. I think you must.
I did because I upheld my oath, and that's what I did. So I have no apologies for it. I would do it again. The Chief Justice showed no signs of contrition for his actions. Because of the magnitude of the decision with regard to sanctions for the Chief Justice's violation of the canons of judicial ethics was a difficult one for this court to make. Finding no other viable alternatives, this court hereby orders that Roy S. Moore be removed from his position of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Alabama. This court is now adjourned.
So you see, in our courts today, the issue is, as this slide will show you, is what Judge Thompson said. I think it's almost basic, you know, I think I would have to start my opinion that way. The issue is, can the state acknowledge God? I think so many times the press, in talking about my case, talked a lot about the Ten Commandments, and people think it was something about a monument and something about failure to remove it. But it was basically about, can the state of Alabama acknowledge God? Well, you know, every state in the Union acknowledges God in their preamble of their Constitution or some part of their law. They acknowledge the sovereignty of God because that's naturally what our country was founded upon. You know that even to be admitted into the country, they had to recognize the Declaration of Independence in their admission. which is acknowledgement of God. So when we talk about the acknowledgement of God, even the judge got that right. And that was basically what we did in that case, is to bring that issue before the court. The judge answered that by saying, while the Chief Justice is free to keep whatever religious belief he chooses, the state may not acknowledge the sovereignty of the Judeo-Christian God and attribute to that God our religious freedom. So the judge basically answered his own question, said that the Chief Justice can believe whatever he wants, but the state of Alabama cannot acknowledge the sovereignty of God or attribute to that God our religious freedom. In that ruling, the judge violated not only the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which is there to acknowledge the sovereignty of God, but also their own opinions, which say our religious liberty comes from God. Now, some of you might not understand why the First Amendment is there to acknowledge God. You see, our forefathers recognized that we were limited in government because government could not interfere with what we believe and what we think. In fact, that right comes from whom? God. And how do we know that? Because the first four commandments tell us that those duties are duties that we owe to God. The duties between God and man are in the first four commandments. And government is not to interfere with those duties. And it all exists because there is a God, a particular God, that gives us that freedom. So therefore, if government today takes away that acknowledgement by the First Amendment, it inverts the First Amendment to prohibit what it was meant to protect. You know, this just happened down in Texas, didn't it? West Texas, there was a West Medina Valley High School that was going to have invocations. And a Judge Fred Byerly, just a few days ago, issued an order that said they could not say benediction, an invocation, amen, or even talk about a God. Well, thankfully, his ruling was overturned just yesterday. And the court did say that the children could go on and recognize their faith in God. But, you know, it is natural for courts to be a little confused. So this judge in this federal court was a little embarrassed when this little boy named Johnny started talking about God. So he asked Johnny a little further. He said, "No, Johnny, I mean, what happens when little boys tell the truth? Or don't tell the truth?" And Johnny looked up to the judge and said, "Well, they go to hell, Judge." Now, if you think the judge was embarrassed talking about God, he really didn't want to talk about hell. And he got a little angry. He said, no, Johnny, I mean, what else happens when little boys don't tell the truth?" And Johnny said, "Gosh, Judge, isn't that enough?" Well, you know, that's the thing in America today. It was enough when our forefathers came into this land. There's the Mayflower Compact. And you can see by the Mayflower Compact that the first thing they did was sign the Mayflower Compact. Do you know why they signed the Mayflower Compact? Does anybody know? They weren't landing where they were supposed to land. They were supposed to land in Jamestown in Virginia. But they were blown off course. And they didn't know where they were landing. We know now they landed at Plymouth Rock. But before they got off the ship, Mayflower, they had to agree one another on some form of government, because there was no government where they were landing. So they signed the Mayflower Compact on November 11, 1620, and they said in that compact, having undertaken for what? The glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, We do by these presents solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic for a better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid. You see, they didn't come to get away from God. They didn't come to get away from the Christian faith. They came to, for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith. You got to realize they had left everything in the old world. They didn't have friends here. They didn't have family here. They didn't have a corner drugstore. They didn't have a McDonald's or Burger King or Walmart or Kmart. They had nothing but God. So they wanted to form the first thing, a civil body politic. Well, guess what that is? Government. And the first thing they recognized is they had to do it in the presence of God. Well, they were a little different than the people we find in our country today, because I think a lot of people are a little embarrassed or ashamed about God. In fact, as I was telling Michael, even to talk about the Constitution, which was founded on the knowledge of God, they don't want to do that. And it's a little strange for them to be bound by any law. They lived out Romans 1:16-17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. You know, I've often said that the whole history of the world can be found in Romans 1. The history of our country can be found in Romans 1. There was a time in Europe, and by the way, the title of this message is The Best of Times and the Worst of Times. And I'm going to try to tell you where we're going as a country, where we're going in the world in this message. But there was a time in Europe when they were not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Everybody recognized there was a God. Oh, they had problems with belief. They had problems with civil government, just like we do today. But they all recognized God, and they were not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It was enough over 150 years later, after the landing the pilgrims at Mayflower, on the Mayflower Plymouth Rock, I should say, that the Declaration of Independence was signed. And those men were not ashamed of God. They said they founded it upon the laws of nature and of nature's God. And they said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Did you ever wonder where they got where Thomas Jefferson believed that these truths were self-evident? You know, another word for self-evident is manifest. And if you look at Romans 1:19-20, it says, because that which may be known of God is what? Manifest in them, self-evident in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. It was evident in them. And it was enough sometime later when the President of the United States took his oath of office. Do you know where he took his oath of office? Washington, D.C., right? No. Washington, D.C. didn't exist. They went to New York City. And the place they took it is still recognized down on, it's near the Wall Street. You know, there's a big bull down on Wall Street, the stock market. Right up at the end of the street is another statue of George Washington. How many of you have ever been there? Right there. Anybody else? Michael, been there? You there? There it stands some 25 to 30 feet high. And it's a statue of George Washington. And on this site in Federal Hall on April 30th, 1789, George Washington took the oath as the first president of the United States. And you can see that statue and stand beneath it, some 25 to 30 feet high it rises, and it's kind of dwarfing. It's kind of, you know, humbling. But I tell you, if you could have been there when he made his first speech, his first act of office, you would have really been excited to hear what he said. He didn't talk exactly like we do today. His whole speech, and I've got it right here, basically the entire speech is about God. He said this, he said, "Such being the impressions under which I have in obedience to the public summons, repaired to the present station," that means just I got here this way, "it would be peculiarly improper to omit in this first official act my fervent supplications to that almighty being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aids can supply every human defect. That his benediction may consecrate to the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States a government instituted by themselves for these essential purposes, and may enable every instrument of that government to employ with success the functions allotted to his charge. In tendering this homage to the great author of every public and private good, I assure myself that it expresses your sentiments, not less than my own, nor those of my fellow citizens at large less than either. No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than the people of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced to the character of an independent nation seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency. You will join with me, I trust, in thinking that there are none under the influence of which the proceedings of a new and free government can more auspiciously commence. And we ought to be no less persuaded that the propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself hath ordained." I mean, he went on and on and on about God. What a great beginning of our country in 1789, the spring of 1789, April 30th. What a great beginning in our country. And after that speech, Congress did something that was quite unusual. And here it is, right in this congressional record, it said that after the oath shall have been administered to the president, that he, attended by the vice president and members of the Senate and House of Representatives, in other words, the whole United States Congress, shall proceed to St. Paul's Chapel. Now, I am particularly fond of history. In fact, Michael took me yesterday to Gettysburg, and it was something to stand on that field and see where so many men, both of the North and the South, lost their lives, fighting for what they believed. And I mean, I was particularly moved because so many of them were from the military academy, West Point. And both sides, you got to understand that just a few years before that battle, they'd been going to the school together. Just like I went to school with my classmates. And now they found themselves on opposite sides fighting each other for what they believed. And so many of them died. In fact, it was estimated that close to 50,000 men died in 3 days in that battle. Never have we fought such a battle in our country. And I was really moved to go and stand and see the fields. And of course, Michael's an expert on these things, and he could tell me, you know, the way they were advancing, and you could just about feel yourself there. Well, the same thing's true here. I would have liked to gone with the Senate and the House and the President and the Vice President to a little chapel. And this chapel had been built in 1766, 10 years before the Declaration of Independence. And I would like to go inside the chapel, but you know, you can't find many buildings built in 1766 anymore. And if you did find any, they would probably be altered in some fashion. Except there is one, St. Paul's Chapel. And how many of you have been there? I'm sure those if you haven't been, the next time you go to New York City, go. Because it's a wonderful trip to go and see where Washington, and if you can't find it, now let me tell you, there are some guideposts. That's the oath. There you go. You see, those twin towers aren't there anymore. But if you go to where they were, at the edge of Ground Zero, only a few hundred yards, you find St. Paul's Chapel. And if you go to the chapel, there's a picture at night. Again, those towers aren't there. And if that's where you go into the chapel. And basically, when you go out the back door, you're standing at the edge of Ground Zero. It's clear they're building, rebuilding the area. And if you go into the chapel, you'll see that. If you get a little closer, you'll see that. The Ten Commandments of God, the cross. That scene is called glory. And I'll tell you why it was put there. It was put there 1 year before Washington went there to cover up something that they could see from the outside that was bothering them. But if you want to find out what that's all about, you'll get a little closer and you'll see that there are the two tables of the law. It's very important. You see, they knew to separate those tables with the first four commandments on one side and the second six on the other side. How many of us today understand what they stand for? The first table of the law is defined in Noah Webster's dictionary in 1828, were the duties we owe to God. And the second table were the duties we owe to each other, our virtue or morality. And Congress can legislate under the second table, under God's law, except for coveting, the last commandment. But they can, for example, make murder, as we have, illegal, adultery, stealing, bearing false witness, duties that you owe to your parents. That's why we have juvenile courts. But they can't make any law respecting an establishment of what? The duties we owe to God in the manner of discharging those duties. That was the definition of religion. They understood that courts had to go by definitions. But today, the courts don't go by definitions. They take that First Amendment to the Constitution and they distort it to prohibit the acknowledgement of God that gave those Ten Commandments. And if you go a little closer, you can see that at the very top of the display, the word Yahweh. That identifies a particular God. And I'll tell you, that's what the issue in our country is about, is denying the state the right to recognize that particular God. Why? Because that God gives us the freedom to worship Him. And our government was limited in a sense that it couldn't interfere with that. In the Bill of Rights, that's the First Amendment is the first of the Bill of Rights. But today that knowledge of God is being taken from us. Well, that debate went on. They didn't stay in the chapel all for the rest of the time they were in Washington. They went back to Federal Hall. And they started in May, right after Washington was sworn in, debating the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. And from May to September, they talked about what words they would put in the First Amendment. And they finally reached a decision on September 24th and September 25th. The two houses. And do you know what the first thing they did after they had written the First Amendment? The very first thing they did was to pass a resolution. September 25th, 1799. Resolved that the Joint Committee of both houses be directed to wait upon the President and request that he recommend to the people a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a constitution of government for their safety and happiness. So isn't it strange that this judge in Texas says you can't even acknowledge God and you can't say a prayer because of the First Amendment? And the first thing that our founding fathers did was ask the President to declare a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording an opportunity peacefully to establish constitutional government. They wanted to thank God for the Constitution. Thank God by recognizing Him in prayer. So what's changed? What's changed over all those years? Have the words changed? No. In fact, I think that's why St. Paul's Chapel is so important. You can actually see where they sat and recognize that that display was there. Now, I know that display was there because I talked to the curator. And I asked the lady there, I said, are you telling me that the Ten Commandments were there when Washington was sitting in this room? I said, yes. So the first thing our whole Congress did was go sit for the Ten Commandments. It's history. And you can learn a lot by the fact that historically, they did exactly what the courts are prohibiting today. And legally, they're not going by the words that they wrote. You know, the first thing, before they even had that resolution, I want to read you what Mr. Boudinot, he was one of the founding fathers, said. He could not think of letting the session pass over without offering an opportunity to all the citizens of the United States of joining with one voice in returning to Almighty God their sincere thanks for the many blessings He had poured down upon them. With this view, therefore, he would move the following resolution, resolved that a joint committee of both houses be directed. You see, even before the resolution, Mr. Boudinot said, I can't think that we should let this occasion pass without letting all the people of our country thank God. Well, 8 days later, the President did exactly what they asked him to do. He established his first it's the first executive order. Think about it. The first proclamation. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. Now, isn't that strange that this President is now saying it's the duty of all nations, not just the United States, but of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. And then he said this, and whereas both houses of Congress have asked me to do this, to recommend to the people a day of public thanksgiving and prayer. He did it on the third day of October, 1789. Now, I didn't put everything he said. I left it off, but there's his proclamation. And listen to this. He established Thursday, the 26th day of November next, to be devoted by the people of the United States to the service of that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. and that we may then unite in rendering him our sincere and humble thanks for his kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, and for the signal and manifold mercies and favorable interpositions of his providence. By the way, what you don't know and what I haven't shown you here is just about a mile away on Long Island across the Hudson River, Washington had been contained by the British on three sides, outnumbered 3-1. And this was in August of 1776, right after the Declaration had been signed. He found his army completely outnumbered, British on all sides. And we know this from a letter by Colonel Ben Talmadge from Connecticut. And it had been raining 4 days, and they were in mud knee-deep. And the next day they knew that the British general would come and take their position, take their army, take everything they had, perhaps kill them. And guess what? You wouldn't be here today. So Washington had to devise a plan. So he started about 10 o'clock at night, deciding that, well, we've got to row across the river, nearly a mile wide. And so he got the boats and started going across the river, dragging the horses through the water. And in the morning, when the sun came up, there were still a whole regiment on duty on the wrong side. And guess what happened? According to Ben Talmadge's letter, a fog came upon the scene and seemed to settle, and this is his words, in a peculiar manner over both encampments. And so particularly dense was the fog that a man could not be seen at 6 yards distance. This peculiar providential occurrence allowed them to escape with the whole army. And this only occurred a few miles from St. Paul's Chapel. About a mile. About a mile from St. Paul's Chapel. And they came across the river into New York, and they knew the British would then follow them, so they went up toward West Point, where I went to school. But before they did, you know what they did? They tried to burn the city, not the British. But the Revolutionary Army felt that if they burned the city, the British couldn't take it. And they weren't very successful. They burnt about a quarter of the city. In September of 1776, and the fire burned right around St. Paul's Chapel, but not St. Paul's Chapel. And that's from history. So in September of 1776 and September of 2001, St. Paul's Chapel survived catastrophe and is still there. And you can still see a portion of history. Well, that's what was happening in the spring of 1789. But across the river, the big river, the Atlantic Ocean, something else was occurring in the old country. It was called what? The French Revolution. It began in 1789. And by 1793, the National Convention had outlawed the public worship of God. A new calendar had been devised. You know, I talked about the new calendar the other night at the Institute on the Constitution, how they had eliminated the Constitution. Well, they devised a new calendar too, and they started eliminating any holidays of religious nature. And they put a holiday to celebrate reason, to celebrate the revolution itself. And by 1794, they were killing the nuns and the priests. In 1794, they hung six Carmelite nuns. It was a new beginning of a new nation that had once recognized God, but now excluded anything about God. Justice William Cushing of the United States Supreme Court described that time. Now, this is taken from a charge to the grand jury in Virginia out of the documentary history of the Supreme Court of the United States, 1789 to 1800, which was a book, a history that had been drafted and drawn up by none other than William Rehnquist, under the authority of William Rehnquist, Chief Justice. Justice William Cushing, one of our first justices, said, "It was during the bloody reign of Robespierre when 400,000 classes of all citizens, men, women, and children, were obliged to submit to the guillotine, to drowning, or to some violent death without trial and without evidence of a crime. When the Christian religion was banished, and men dared not assemble together the first day of the week to worship their Creator, when a member in convention could arise and announce himself an atheist with public applauses. This certainly was not a time of true liberty, but a reign of wild anarchy, terror, and cruelty. It was a time when they were getting rid of anything about God. A time when you could stand up in convention and say, 'I'm an atheist,' and everybody would applaud." This description came from a justice on our United States Supreme Court. It's a time when they knew God, they glorified in Europe, in France, when they glorified God not as God, when they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful but became vain in their imaginations, their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things." And you know, that's what's going on in our country today, isn't it? Isn't that what we're doing? Isn't that what this Justice Fred Byerly did in Texas? What your Supreme Court does, what the President does, what the members of Congress have done, and what the Supreme Court does on a regular basis by denying the sovereignty of God. It's nothing new. It's been going on for years. But you see, in France they were doing it, and in America we were establishing a nation established on God. At the same time, in the spring of 1789, we were acknowledging God. In the fall of 1789, they began the French Revolution. Well, where are we going today? On April 4th, 2003, at the Washington, D.C. Omni Sheraton Hotel, at the American Society of International Law, another justice of the Supreme Court by the name of Stephen Breyer said something else. He said this. He said, "After all, what could be more exciting for an academic practitioner or judge than the global legal enterprise that is now upon us? Wordsworth's words about the French Revolution will, I hope, still ring true. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be very young was heaven. But to be young was very heaven." He was praising the French Revolution. He was praising and saying, Wordsworth wrote that it was bliss to be alive. Well, unfortunately, 400,000 people weren't alive anymore, because they killed them, according to Justice Cushing. But here was a justice on the Supreme Court saying it was a good time. Do you think that maybe he knew what he was saying? And do you think that maybe the people of our country didn't? Or just didn't know? You know, that's the amazing thing about what's going on today, is there's so much going on that we're closing our eyes to it. We're acting as if it doesn't exist. We've got a president, which was mentioned, that is declaring every June to be a day to celebrate sodomy. And where's the outcry from the church? Do you know in this recent May 31st proclamation, and we're just talking about a few days ago, and quite frankly, I don't believe the president draws these things up. It's people under him. People draw it up for him, but it carries the sign of the White House, that they are making a more perfect union. In a prior proclamation, he said they exhibited the best qualities of civil servants. But you see, by Justice Breyer's statement, where we're going as a nation. You know, it reminds me of a story of a man by the name of Oscar Davis. Oscar was born, he was a little odd-looking. He was, you know, had a long nose, he was tall, he spoke funny, and big feet. And Oscar, the strangest thing about Oscar was his middle initial was D. And if you put his initials, Oscar D. Davis, it's O-D-D, odd. And people naturally in school caught on with that, and as he was a young boy in school, they teased him about being different, about being odd. In fact, they started calling him odd. And they'd say, well, here's odd, there's odd. Have you seen odd today? And he got really fed up with being called odd. So he decided that when he died, he didn't want his name on the tombstone. He didn't want anybody going by his tombstone and said, there's odd, you know. So he family honored his request, and he died, and they put his date of birth and date of his death, and people would go by the tombstone and say, well, that's odd. Sometimes you just can't get away with it. But I'll tell you what is odd. I'll tell you what's really odd, that people that are looking at our country today are wondering what in the world is going on in America. I talked to some South Korean Christian law students, and they tell me that homosexuality is being pushed in their country because of us. What a disgrace we are. A country that was to represent the law of God is now pushing homosexuality internationally. And if you don't believe it, go to the White House on the internet and look up the proclamation that was just released that says we're doing it internationally. So we've got a problem. Woodrow Wilson said a long time ago, now I don't like to quote Woodrow Wilson necessarily because he started the League of Nations, which failed, but he was a historian and he did say something that I quote. It says, a nation which does not remember what it was yesterday, does not know what it is today, nor what it's trying to do. We are trying to do a futile thing if we do not know where we came from or what we've been about. And I believe that's a good description of our country today. We don't know where we're going. We don't know what we're trying to do. Why? Because we don't know where we came from anymore. We have forgotten that this nation is the only nation in the history of the world founded upon the law of God. Israel wasn't founded upon the law of God. It was given the law. South Africa, Australia, Canada weren't specifically founded on the law of God. But in America in 1776, it was specifically stated that this nation was entitled to exist because of the law of God. Now, a lot of people don't know what this laws of nature or nature's God means. But they were legal phrases, the law of nature and the law of God. Upon these two foundations, the law of nature and the law of revelation, depend all human laws, that is to say, no human law should be suffered to contradict these. Our forefathers knew the law. Ronald Reagan said it best when he said that the nation, if we ever forget that we're one nation under God, we'll be a nation gone under. And I'm wondering if we're going under because we have forgotten that we're a nation under the sovereignty of God. That's a book that I wrote to explain what went on in Montgomery. And that's the Foundation for Moral Law where I work. You know, I heard this song that Michael sung, "Oh, Beautiful for Spacious Skies," and I guess that just makes me want to say that poem, "America the Beautiful." America the Beautiful, or so you used to be. Land of the Pilgrims' pride, but I'm glad they're not here to see. Babies piled in dumpsters, abortion on demand. Oh, sweet land of liberty, your house is on the sand. Your children wander aimlessly, poisoned by cocaine, choosing to indulge their lust when God has said abstain. And from sea to shining sea, this nation is turned away from teaching of God's law and the need to always pray. Well, there's a lot of worldly pastors telling lies about our rock, saying that God is going broke so that they can fleece the flock. Is that what's going on today? I'm glad they're not here with us to see the mess we're in. That's another poem. We've given up our righteousness for a life of indulgent sin. For when abortion is no longer murder and sodomy is deemed right, then good is now called evil and darkness is now called light. No longer does man see a need for God when he's in full control. For the only truth, self-evident, is in the latest poll. But with it, man is his own master. We fail to count the cost. Our precious freedoms vanish and our liberties are lost. Our children are told they can't pray in school and they teach some evolution. Why can't they see the fear of God is the only true solution? Our schools have become the battleground while all across the land, Christians just shrug their shoulders, afraid to take a stand. From the grave you can hear their voices cry, the victory has already been won. Just glorify the Father, as did his only Son. And when your work on this earth is done, you've traveled where we trod, we'll leave the land you left to us, one nation under God. Now I skip from one poem to another poem, so I hope y'all forgive me, but it just seemed appropriate. But you know, we're here today fulfilling what's written in Malachi, aren't we? I quoted this last night somewhat, but then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another. And that's it's Malachi, if you want to look it up, the 3rd chapter, 16th verse through 18 and 4th chapter. And you know, Malachi is the last book in the Bible before Matthew, before the coming of Christ. That's the last book. It said, then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written for him, before him, for them that feared his name. And that thought upon the name of the Lord. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in the day that I make up my jewels. And I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. You see, God's coming back. And he's going to judge between those that serve him and those that serve him not. Now, I'm really honored to be in this church and be among people that are serving God. And believe me, you may think you're few in number, but all across this land, there's people waking up to the knowledge of God. And I'm approached everywhere I go. So don't think you're alone. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall leave them neither root nor branches. But unto you that fear my name will the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And he shall go forth and grow up as calves in the stall. And he shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of the feet in the day that I do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses, which I commanded him in Horeb to all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. But so, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of that great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and charge the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. You know, when I see these kids going up, and I see the father bring his little boy down, that kind of didn't want to go down all the way. Well, that's okay. We don't want to go all the way sometimes, do we? But we learn that we got to. And that's what the father is teaching the child. Got to go. And someday he'll be leading his father. That's the way it happens. He's turned the hearts of the fathers to the children, the hearts of the children to the fathers and the mothers. And you mothers are probably better teachers sometimes than the fathers. But the fathers are leaders, and the children will follow. Even if they sometimes turn away, they come back. Anybody's had children like mine, I can tell you that from my own experience, that's what happens. They come back. And that's our job today, isn't it? And I don't care whether you're a father or a grandfather or hadn't even had children yet. You've got the same job, is to teach these children about God and teach them about the history that you see that I've shown you today. How many of us didn't understand that history? And I'll tell you, it's such a blessing to have it right there, just like Gettysburg. I mean, it's not too far from you. Go find out what they did and how they fought and how they died. But today we don't give up much sometimes. What a blessing it is to let God be your guide. And what a blessing it is to know that God's still in charge of this country. Isn't that, you know, a good thing? Give him a hand. Let's thank God that the ones that they think are controlling the country aren't really in control. That he's still got a purpose for our country. And we can still acknowledge him and will acknowledge him no matter what we're told, as is evidenced by that video clip. May God bless you. Bless the state of Maryland, the United States of America. Thank you.